You've heard it every way. A dog will have his day. But when it comes to wailing, dogs ain't got a thing to say. So they can do the waiting, cause I ain't hesitating. The future's round the corner, so for now I'm gonna play. Now's the time to wail. Not later, but right now's the time.
That's Vi Red, one of the few women in jazz playing the alto sax, sax and on vocals, with Now's the Time from her very first album, Bird Call, released in 1962. She was influenced by her father, drummer Alton Red. Her discography is not that extensive, but there is quality in every single one of her performances. After her career in jazz, she went back to school and became a teacher in the 1970s. She's 85 years old, if she's around still, and I think she still is around today. Roy Ayers on vibes, Carmel Jones, trumpet, Russ Freeman, piano, Leroy Vinegar on bass, and Richie Goldberg, her husband, on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Nutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, May the 28th, and a lot to get going with today. First up, 10 years ago, the United Nations established MINUSTA, that's the acronym for the United Nations Stabilization Mission in Haiti. It was established according to Security Council Resolution 1542, in the aftermath of the upheaval, a political upheaval in Haiti that saw President Jean Bertrand Aristide fleeing into exile. And then in 2010, the earthquake hits, the devastating earthquake, and the forces remained. Well, our guest today tells us that Haiti has been trying to get these international forces out. His name is Kim Ives. He is a veteran journalist. He's editor with the Haiti Liberté, a newsweekly covering the Haitian community in Haiti and the Haitian diaspora. And he has been with us several times talking about issues and developments in Haiti. Kim, thanks for being with us today.
Always a pleasure, Yutrice.
Thank you. Well, I know you were in Brazil in connection with Haiti. You have to tell us about that.
Well, it was part of a campaign which has been basically prosecuted for the last 5 or 6 years by large sectors of the Haitian community, but in particular, Senator Moïse Jean-Charles has emerged not only as the principal voice speaking out against the corruption and malfeasance of the Martelly government, but also against the UN military occupation of Haiti, the only UN peacekeeping mission in the Western Hemisphere. And it's about 9,000 soldiers, that's soldiers and police, and has the Brazilian troops are the principal contingent, about 2,200, and it has had Brazilian generals at the head of it since its deployment on June 1st, 2004. It's an interesting story because how did Brazil end up at the head of something like this? We have to go back to the coup of 2004 against President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Essentially, the U.S., France, and Canada wanted to get him out. He was seen as a threat to their interests in that country, even though maybe he wasn't, but he nonetheless was targeted by the Bush administration in particular as someone who had to go. And so they carried out a coup d'etat, which was disguised as popular uprising. That's how the U.S. does its coup d'etats these days. And he was bundled onto a plane and flown to the Central African Republic. And U.S., French, and Canadian troops were actually already on the ground on February 29, 2004, when he was taken out. And was as happened in the first coup d'etat against him, because the U.S. did this twice, the U.S. handed it off to the U.N., and it was who was going to lead this. And Haiti is a country which loves soccer. They never accepted the game of baseball as the Dominican Republic across the border that shares the island of Hispaniola did, and sort of as part of their resistance, they always held on to soccer. And so Brazil was always sort of the unofficial team of Haiti. The Haitian team never got to the World Cup except once in 1974. And so it was a natural choice. And so the president of Brazil at the time, who had just come in, Lula, had, as a number of countries do, had hoped that he could get a permanent seat on the UN Security Council. There is a movement, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, in the UN to try to diversify it from the five members that presently sit there. And Brazil, which is, of course, to be in BRICS, saw itself as one of the foremost candidates, but heading a peacekeeping mission was sort of seen as sort of the test run you had to do to get there, or at least that's what UN or U.S. officials apparently told him. Yeah, but it was kind of a ruse and, pretty obvious one. And so essentially they've used the Brazilians. And so to make this already somewhat long story, somewhat shorter, essentially Senator Moise Jean Charles teamed up with a current in the Workers' Party, which is the ruling party, Lula's party in Brazil, now headed as president by Dilma Rousseff. A current in that party called O Trabalho basically reached out to Senator Moise, and the two of them have campaigned really among elected officials and unionists and city councils, and just gone crisscross the country doing talks and presentations and lobbying. And essentially it's gotten to the point where there is huge pressure from the Brazilian grassroots for Brazil to pull out of this role of doing Washington's dirty work and leave the country, which would leave Minister basically having to pull out. It should be said that Minister was deployed in 2004. It was supposed to be there for 6 months. And now here we are a decade later, and there's still no end in sight. They're talking vaguely about maybe in 2016 we'll draw down, but it's a little bit like the Afghanistan thing we've seen with Obama. You keep having this sort of date which keeps rolling off into the future. So
so in your trip to Brazil with these talks, what came of them?
Well, essentially, the key has been the parliament, and the Senate Human Rights Commission, which is a very in Brazil, which is a very influential commission, voted unanimously to call for the troops to come out. I mean, this a few years ago would be unheard of, but it now has happened, and that was after Senator Moise came and met with them. And in addition, even though they didn't take a vote, the Human Rights Commission of the deputies also met with him and issued a vote, and they both said, and they're quite influential leaders in the PT, in both of these commissions, said they're going to work to pass that resolution in Parliament. Senator Moise has been to Haiti now, Brazil now, three times. He was there in December at the PT Congress, where he met Dilma Rousseff and buttonholed her and said, you know, can we get the troops out? She made some vague promises that she'd work towards that. But these senators and deputies are now saying they're going to put a resolution so that in October, when in fact the vote for an 11th year of a minister will be coming up at the UN, they intend to have a resolution in Parliament which would say that Brazil has to pull out, in which case this would pretty much pull the linchpin out of MINUSTA, and I think the Washington, Paris, and Ottawa would have no choice but to say it's over. A little bit, that's how it happened in 1999 with the first UN occupation of Haiti, which we call Missivi. Basically, China was mad at the U.S. For various reasons, but among them because Taiwan was mucking around in Haiti. And basically, they put a veto on the continuation of it. And that way, at that point, the Missivi had to be pulled out, and they weren't able to meddle in elections. And essentially, that's how probably Jean-Bertrand Aristide was able to be elected overwhelmingly for a second time in 2000. I should say in 2010-11, MINUSTA played a key role in basically thwarting the popular will and the vote of Haiti and making sure that Martelly got in. They acted as the handmaiden of Washington in that, and basically the candidate that came in second was kicked out, Martelly was put in, and then he went on to win the presidency. So they are playing a sort of a coup, making what the an OAS ambassador called an electoral coup d'etat making role.
This is a very interesting development because, on the one hand, for popular consumption, for the world consumption, this military presence, especially in the aftermath of Jean-Bertrand Aristide's exile, as they call it, as if he decided one morning, hey, you know what, today's a good day to go into exile, mm-hmm. as if there were no compelling factors related to that, the fact that he was taken out of office. Yeah. That this force, in fact, was necessary to stabilize a very explosive situation. It's a pacification effort, we know. But at the same time, even though we know what the intention was, did it ironically serve in any way as a stabilizing force at any time in Haiti because things were literally very, very explosive?
Well, that's what the Brazilians would like to argue, and of course the U.S. But the fact is, no, I think, you know, Haiti is... I could say the oldest democracy in this hemisphere, because I wouldn't consider the slaveocracy that emerged in 1776 in the U.S., which is the only other independent country before Haiti, to be a real democracy. They have managed pretty well over the years, despite embargoes and sabotage and all sorts of destabilization campaigns that have been run against the country since the time of Thomas Jefferson. they've managed to basically build and run their country themselves. And I think that the role of the United Nations has really been, and you can see that in the WikiLeaks that Haiti Liberté published back in 2011, has really been one of imposing outside agendas on the country. And this creates more instability. And as Senator Moise was arguing, he said essentially this force is there to guarantee that foreign multinationals and our local oligarchy can exploit the natural resources of Haiti, in particular, say, the $20 billion of gold dust that is, seems to be sprinkled in Haitian mountaintops. We talked about that, I think, in one of our last times on your show, Beatrice.
Yes.
And, you know, he said this is primarily why they're there, to guard. And, you know, we have to remember that essentially the UN peacekeeping force has become the discount strike force for the U.S. empire. In fact, the General Accounting Office of the U.S. government did a study and said which would cost more, putting Marines or U.N. peacekeepers in there, and they found that putting U.N. peacekeepers cost about half of what it would cost to deploy U.S. troops. So essentially, they are a destabilizing force. They are an affront to Haitian sovereignty, which is very deep. The people don't like them. It's a waste of money, $850 million a year. Basically, billions and billions have been spent on this force to do, in the best case, nothing, but in the worst case, to carry out massacres in rebellious slums like Cité Soleil and Bel Air, who resisted the coup d'etat against President Aristide.
In the meantime, though, we see a very troubling pattern, a very familiar pattern, in that the Martinique government is seeming to want to install itself as government for life. It has been frustrating the calls for popular elections. What's going on there?
Well, that's exact. I mean, he boasted in his campaign that he was card-carrying Tonton Macoute, or Volunteer for National Security, VSN, as they used to call it back in the Duvalierist days. You would get a little card with your picture and everything on it. Since he was age 16, that's what President Michel Martelly said. And he is a neo-Duvalierist. He, at one point, said in his campaign, for the past 25 years, we've been off track. 25 years prior was when Jean-Claude Duvalier was somewhat unceremoniously put on a C-130 with his Ferraris and his wife's mink coats and sent into a golden exile in France. So not surprisingly, he recycled a lot of the Duvalier era's politicians, but above all their children, because it had been long enough that now it was their second generation of Duvaliers which were coming in. And we've seen this fairly savvy, I could say, march to establish a kind of a dictatorship. It shouldn't really be a surprise. In 1997, in Miami Weekly, down in your neck of the woods, Beatrice, the New Times ran a long, extensive article by a journalist called Elise Ackerman, a long interview with Martelly, where he was talking about his ambitions to become president then. And he said, the first thing I've got to do is dissolve the parliament, because you're not going to get anything done with all of them in the country. And essentially, that's what we're coming down to. There's been one-third of the Senate expired. Their terms expired back in 2011 when Martelly came in. They were supposed to be replaced an election, but it has now been 3 years. Martelly has not carried out any election, and so he's sort of dissolving the parliament by letting it just time out. And the U.S., of course, has gotten very antsy with this because, you know, the showcase election is always their mantra, and have been putting some pressure. But the fact remains that the elections are still a long way off. And the key what's the word in, I know in French, not English, it's usually the opposite. The key bone of contention is the Electoral Council, which essentially Martelly handpicked his own Electoral Council and was trying to carry out this election with that. But Senator Moïse Jean-Charles, along with really a core of five other colleagues in what remains of the Senate, it's still a functional Senate, there are usually 30 senators, they're now 20, so they still have a quorum, but they have been blocking this attempt of Martelly to carry out yet another electoral coup like the one that brought him to power, and have said, no, we have to do it according to the Constitution, which calls on each sector of the nation, churches, students, education sector, labor, owners, etc., to give representatives for the nine-member CEP, that Central Provisional Electoral Council, they call it a CEP, CEP, and to put them, and then the president picks from two people they give, and that's how it's formed. That's how it was done under President Preval. Martelly has resisted this. It's what they call Article 289 of the Haitian Constitution. And he doesn't want to go down this road, which is a very straightforward. It's a way, really, to do it in a pretty democratic way, really, probably more so than our electoral college here, to carry out your election. But Martelly has resisted, and it seems, even though they've talked about doing the election on October 26th, it is not going to happen. And then what will happen is in January of 2015, the Senate and a lot of the deputies will, in fact, time out, and there will no longer be a functioning parliament, and then Martelly will be able to rule by decree. So that's kind of the standoff we have. And once again, Senator Moïse Jean-Charles is very much the leader of that movement to stop this tricky takeover.
Well, we need to connect with some of the folks who have a different picture of leadership in Haiti, and I'm hoping that we will be doing that together soon, Kim. I want to thank you so much for bringing us up to snuff on this effort to get rid of the so-called international stabilizing peacekeeping forces in Haiti, and on the matter of popular elections, which should take place soon, but we're seeing the efforts to frustrate it, and now we understand the tactic behind it. And we have a lot more to cover, but that would be for the next time. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Utrecht, for having me.
Thank you so much. Well, I tell you, I mean, all kinds of things are going on in the world where people just are finding all kinds of ways to subvert democracy. The irony is, of course, the people who are doing so are the ones who talk publicly about democracy and freedom and do everything possible to frustrate it. I want to touch on this issue of Boko Haram. It comes today news that the former president of Nigeria, Olusegun Obasanjo, has stepped in as a kind of intermediary to broker some kind of a deal between Boko Haram, who have been keeping, the number fluctuates, but most people think it's about at least 270 schoolgirls in their grasp, and of course are looking to trade them for prisoners they believe are being held by the Nigerian government. We had earlier in the week the implausible position by the defense forces of Nigeria saying that they know where the girls are, but they just don't want to go and get them because it would be endangering their lives. It's a very strange thing to announce, it seems to me, from a purely tactical point of view. But in any event, former President Obasanjo has stepped in and is said to be negotiating. He's said to be meeting with members of the relatives of Boko Haram. And so they are serving as intermediaries, and he is favoring a negotiated settlement to this. In the meantime, of course, Boko Haram continues to escalate its violence. Other people have been killed in excess of 50. It's heading now toward 100 more people being killed in attacks on small villages. And there is a sense by the people of Nigeria that Obasanjo's role is a foil against what they seem to, what they have been regarding as inaction by President Goodluck Jonathan, whose position officially is that he does not favor any negotiation at all. However this works out, it is at least a response. And we, of course, we'll be hearing the results of it to see whether, in fact, it takes hold or whether it produces anything that anybody could live with. It's a very, very delicate and very horrible situation to have to deal with, any country having to deal with. But it is quite telling that the former president, not the current one, is the person who is now looked to as a person providing a possible solution to this horrible crisis. But what I wanted to talk about was the fact that Nigeria's wealthy people, and they are embarrassingly wealthy, they're at least more billionaires in Nigeria than in the rest of the country, in the rest of the continent, sorry, put together. And they're in all kinds of industries. I'm talking unbelievable amounts of wealth. And you don't hear anything from this group, except that, you know, as long as their interests are protected, and they're usually in oil and gas and in other related industries, but their entire concentration has been, as long as the oil fields are left alone, they don't care about the damage being done to anything or anyone. And it is really revolting, I think, that you have a group of people, and it brings to mind, again, the need for Nigeria and Africa as a whole to really re-examine itself, that you have this country which is the wealthiest on the continent, where more than 60% of the population is in dire poverty, and where in a situation like this, where national concerns are at stake and lives are lost by the thousands now over at least 5 years, you have these folks just going along. It's just about money. As long as nothing interferes with our ability to make more and more money, we couldn't care less about what's happening. I wouldn't be surprised if it turns out that this particular sector is actually paying money to folks like Boko Haram to just, you know, fight those people over there. Just leave our stuff alone. Because it's been very telling that we haven't seen explosions at oil fields and, you know, pipelines and the typical kinds of things that terrorists target. They're killing each other. but the oil continues to flow. It is a really incredible comment on what in Nigeria and for the African Union as a whole, what has emerged as the focus of attention for people who are in a position to create change, are in a position to affect outcomes, that their only response in a situation like this is, we don't care about governments. Why? Because we own planes. We can pack everything we have onto planes. We can rent whatever it is we need to rent, get our Bugattis and our Ferraris on them, and we can fly out and come back when things settle down. Let them kill each other. We don't care. We're not interested in all of that. We just want, when we look at our stocks and how they're going, that they're doing very, very well. I mean, you have people making obscene amounts of money in Nigeria. And it doesn't, I've been waiting to see some response, some entreaty by them as a group, as the so-called captains of industry. But this too, and this speaks to those folks who are nationalists, this is the obscene history of Africa as well, where the attitudes and the actions of the marauders who came not only adopted, but they're fully enforced by this new class that has emerged as the owners of resources and the managers of the resources of the country. In their minds, I guess, they own the government and they can command the government to do its will. But as far as you can interpret it from the outside, you can see that their view is, this thing is not happening to us, so we have no reason to worry. This is happening to those people. And at some point or the other, it will all work itself out. Either way, it is not our problem. That is quite a commentary. Quite a commentary. It is shameful. It is disgraceful. And it ought to be spoken about very publicly. And these people ought to be shamed. Because here you have, for the first time really in history, in modern history anyway, because there was a time when people did have obscene amounts of wealth in Africa in ancient times, but in modern times, we're talking today, by any standard, with more than two dozen billionaires in Nigeria, you would think that there would be some kind of a coordinated response, some kind of a public statement even, about their concern for their country and their countrymen. And next I want to talk about Mr. Snowden. Tonight, NBC's Brian Williams will be conducting an interview with Ed Snowden, and it's a big deal, because now it's, you know, he has outdone everybody. Brian Williams has outdone CNN's Anderson Cooper, and he's outdone Barbara Walters, and he has practically outdone everybody, the big stars of the media, and he has cinched an interview with Ed Snowden. Now, I want you to remember that right off the bat, I did tell you this guy is a spy. I did tell you there's something about him that does not smell right. Supposedly in tonight's interview, he will admit, but he would say it this way, I was trained as a spy. I mean, what is that? As the song says, is you is or is you ain't? Answer, you is. He's a spy. And the reason we know about Ed Snowden, as I would remind you, I said this right off the bat, the reason we know him at all is that they were about 3 seconds too late in snatching him up. He knew that they were going to come for him. He knew that his cover was blown. He knew that they were on to him. And for his own safety and his own life, he had to come public. And all of this stuff, as we will see, and because I'm going to come back to this tomorrow, all of this, this carefully choreographed public effort, this campaign to instill fear in the public about, well, of course, it's a justified fear. Nobody wants to be comfortable with the idea that the government is spying on you. So they whip up this whole thing. The government is spying on you. Well, when has the government not been spying on people? Black folks have been saying this since the 50s. Nobody was listening. The government has always spied. Now, you will see if you listen to this tonight, we'll come back to the discussion in tomorrow. You will see now, as you go back, how the entire public is being manipulated by this guy and a group of people around him, and they're playing a very dangerous kind of game. The media's role, Brian Williams and NBC's role, is to facilitate what the government wants. Remember, I told you, there have been negotiations. There's no way these stories could be written without government approval. It's all government approved. What they want to do is to bring him back home because he went off the script. And he did a lot of damage, but what we don't know is the damage he was about to do as he got caught. It is quite possible he was working both sides. It was quite possible he was spying for a whole bunch of governments besides the United States. And what they're trying to do is to make it look like this. I mean, eventually he's going to make the effort to come back home. We have John Kerry saying, well, you should man up and come home. Look, we know this is how they do it. They would kick up a fuss and make it look like, well, this was all, you know, the government can't stand Snowden, and Snowden has done this, and he claims he's a whistleblower. He's actually a spy. Come on, you're a spy. And they will go through all these permutations to legitimize what has already been negotiated. And that is, look, you know you're going to have to do some time. We'll try and figure out some way, and we'll make it look, we'll kind of put it in a way where we can all face the public. The government gets to wag its finger at him. They go through this motion of the court. He goes through this whole thing about now he comes forward and all this time and says, yes, I was a spy. Well, you see how it goes? And all the time, these stories were being leaked out as part of the campaign to keep his Trump card hot. And that was to keep his connection with the people going. We do not know a whole bunch of things around this guy. And again, as I said, I'm a news person, and I could smell it from 10 miles away. This guy is bad news. And we don't know half of what it is that needs to be known. But we have been discussing, I have been giving you hints. You just analyze what's going on, and you can see that this guy is deep into some stuff, and he's part of a global network, and they're now trying to dislodge these people who have parked themselves and their methodologies of collecting information, because as I had posited, I have no proof of it, but it was a theory of mine, that people like Snowden and counterparts like that are ensconcing themselves in governments all over the world. And at some point, they will become the power of the world because they will control the information of the world. We see how this these pieces have been coming together. Omidyar, Pierre Omidyar of PayPal, who is now the sponsor of Glenn Greenwald. Greenwald is back in the U.S. No charges have been brought against him, and he's operating like any other publisher. He's the editor of The Intercept. And we know that Omidyar has been in and out of the White House more than any other private citizen in the United States. We know that his PayPal organization has been extremely cooperative with the NSA and all other government intelligence operations. He is the funder now of a media outfit, so he has his own mechanism to control thought and opinion, just like Jeff Bezos, who now owns the Washington Post. These folks are into some very deep stuff. And it is not simply to be assumed, oh, that he's a whistleblower. He is not a whistleblower. Don't ever mistake Matt Snowden for a whistleblower. That's not what he is. He's into deep stuff. It's big. And now the choreography is being cemented with this so-called interview. You know, it's as if Brian Williams and NBC are insisting, well, this was quite a coup to get him because of, you know, this was secret. Get out of here. Everybody knows this. Everybody in the intelligence community knew that this event was happening. They permitted it. They orchestrated it. They were part of it. You think NBC independently had this thing going? No. They're part of the operation. They have to give it this the smell test. They're trying to make this thing pass the smell test. But Ed Snowden, as I said from the beginning, and now we are going to hear it from his own lips tonight, is a spy. A new kind of spy. The young kind of spy. The kind of technocrats. These are, in fact, the people we talked about very early on last year when we talked about the new oligarchs. These are the people, him and people like Mr. WikiLeaks himself. They have organized a layer of global control. It sounds almost like one of those Marvel comics or something, but they have organized a system of global control that is now deeply embedded in many, many governments. And they control information. And they're working all angles. Everybody is a possible client. When you look at this interview tonight, and you look at Mr. Snowden still pretending that, you know, he is just a saintly young man, a very stand-up American guy fighting for freedom in the American way in the Constitution. But in fact, he was a spy. The questions will never be asked. Who are you spying for? That was the question I asked. The first question I asked was, who are you working for? Who is he working for? Use your brain. This is not that difficult to figure out. Somebody shows up and says, oh, they're spying on you. Well, okay, I get it. We told you so in the 50s, as I said. You're late to the story. But it did resonate, and it was calculated to resonate with people all over the world. You get them all shaken up, and you get them to doubt their governments, and you get them to create discord in their countries, and you get them distracted. Nobody has ever asked him, who the heck are you spying for? The question still stands. But I wanted to bring to your attention, this is how governments, everybody in this whole thing is lying. Every one of them is lying. Don't believe anybody. They all are lying. They need to bring this ugly development to a reasonably tidy close. Glenn Greenwald has come home already. He's landed, and believe it or not, he is actually passing the smell test. Nobody's asking who is he, who he is working for. He has a legitimate job. And he has a patron with very, very close ties to the White House. And so he could come back to the United States and be a venture capitalist slash publisher slash editor slash activist in behalf of all of our collective human rights. So he's taken care of. The big problem is Snowden, because of course it was Snowden who is at the epicenter of all of this, and Snowden who was caught. So now they have to find a way to bring him so he could land back in the U.S. They're going to raise all kinds of fuss and whatnot. As I told you, there is nothing that has been published so far that does any real damage to the intelligence systems and methods of the United States. They haven't, and all the stuff about the collecting information, it's just silly stuff. It's incidental stuff. That's no big deal. You know, they put a panel together, they come up with new rules, they say, okay, these are the new rules, and it's done. So they will give him a way to come back. Everybody makes nice. He will go on to command very high speaking fees. Barack Obama will go and leave office in 2 years, and this would be behind everybody. There'll be books written and movies made, and everybody will make a lot of money. And the question still will never be answered. Who the heck are you working for, Ed Snowden? Who are you spying for? Who is paying you? I've been around the block a couple of times. And from the very beginning, I know I got a couple of people saying, I can't agree with you on this. I don't know how you could call him a spy. Well, this is the power of propaganda, the power of manipulation of the mind. And we are all going through it. And they are all lying. Every single one of them. The government is lying. Snowden is lying. Greenwald, they all are lying. All of them are lying. And so you have to keep your senses. You have to remain alert, because the most precious piece of real estate is between your ears, and everybody wants 100% occupation of it and possession of it. And look at what is going on and tell you, you know, it's a Groucho Marx line. Do you believe me or your lying eyes? I want to tell you that what you are seeing, what every fiber in your body tells you, is common sense. They tell you that you're just not thinking right. You need to think what I think, and then you'll be thinking right. Whistleblower, give me a break. So we'll see. And he says, I was trained. I've never heard somebody say this. I was trained as a spy. Well, did you take the training well? Did it take? I was trained as a spy. Get out of here. You're a spy. That's what, as they say, that's what you is. You is a spy. Mr. Snowden, and you are not fooling me one bit. But it would be interesting to see how they land this bird, because it's a very unwieldy landing, but they have to land it, because now more than ever, especially with developments between the U.S. and Russia over Ukraine and all of that stuff, they need to have the assets back. The question is, how tainted is Mr. Snowden? Nobody knows how pure he is anymore. Is he a good spy anymore, or is he a bad spy? Can he be rehabilitated and forgiven? Let him go on a nice spree of making lots and lots of money making speeches and continuing the illusion that he's a fine, upstanding citizen. They'll do everything possible to make this bird land. I want to thank you for joining me today, and I hope that this was gave you some reason to think and to value PRN, to value this particular program. I love this program, and I love the listeners of this program, because I see from your notes and from your letters and your quick little messages that it has come to be a necessary reference point for you and for me too. This is where I think the next leg of the race is, in encouraging people to gather someplace where we can exchange information, opinions, and ideas. So thank you so much. A pleasure and a privilege to be in your company. See you tomorrow.